It is my pleasure to introduce our main speaker, Lynn W. from Laguna Beach.
Hi, everyone. I'm Lynn Wilder, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm delighted to be here tonight sober through a loving God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank my friend for having me, my friend Bob, for giving me this privilege. I've been to this group before. I tell you what, if you don't think your home group's the best group in the world, then you better find another home group. But this is a hell of a group, I want to tell you. And it's wonderful to come into a group like this with the energy that's here, but in particular, the structure that's here. And I love it. You know, I'm reading this newsletter tonight that my old friend over here, I've known a long time, puts together every week. It just blows me away. It's wonderful. I looked at that. I had no idea that there were 9 English-speaking meetings in Iraq. And that's just one of the things on it. And also the history. And this is a great history period in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the last day of May. But on the 10th and 11th of this month, I'm sure most of you know it, but that's when the 10th was when Bill was in the Mayflower Hotel, and he looked up and he made that call to Henrietta Seiberling. And the 11th is when he and Dr. Bob met in the gatehouse. And, you know, I've just come off of a sober cruise to Alaska with Charlie doing the Big Book. And I love history. I love the Big Book. I love everything about Alcoholics Anonymous. And the one thing I'm going to tell you up front, and it's never wavered, and that is that Alcoholics Anonymous is the single most important thing that's ever happened in my lifetime, without exception. I've got a home group. It's the Anderson Group. It's meeting tonight. I'm there on a regular basis. I've got a sponsor. His name is Dave Cook. I've always had a sponsor. I've never changed sponsors. They've all died. And that makes Dave a little nervous. And my sobriety date is March the 5th, 1965. And for that, I'm totally grateful. And Alcoholics Anonymous and my loving God, thank you for those applause. And that lady that talked first up here, I love her. She did not tell you, but she has 32 years of continuous sobriety. I love Katie. We've got a lot of history together. I've called her Mother Superior for years. When I first met her, she was a drunken nun. But God love her. You know, this deal is just incredible. I'm always reminded from whence I cometh. I was telling the guys today, I usually drive when I come up here, and but I flew in today, and Bob was nice enough to pick me up at the airport, Bob and a couple of guys, and I'm going to fly out early in the morning. And I'll never forget, I did business up here for a number of years, but I'll never forget the morning, and every time I come into Vegas, I remember it, flying in, and the MGM was on fire. And looking out the airplane, and a lot of you in here are probably maybe too young to remember that, but I remember it vividly. And I had some restaurants up here, and we immediately started to cook food and to send it down there. And a lot of memories. Probably fortunate for Vegas, I never got here drunk. I got everywhere else. And that, you know, basically is... But I've been active in Alcoholics Anonymous for a long, long time, and I'm grateful for that. You know, listening to Charlie last week on the Big Book, and, you know, I got sober the old-fashioned way. It's called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was immediately put into the book and into step study meetings, and I'll tell you tonight a little bit about how I was introduced to the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, but that's always been my foundation. And I've always been grateful to the old-timers because they saved my life. And we were talking a little about that on the way from the airport and at dinner tonight. But I'm a Californian by residence, a Kentuckian by birth, and an alcoholic by absorption. And I drank as much as I could for as long as I could, and it damn near killed me at a young age. I came into the world, my story is one of drinking at both ends of the spectrum. And I'm not going to take you through all of it, but I'll just tell you that the pain was equally as great at both ends. I came into the world into a loving family. You know, we've heard around for the last 20 years, we've heard a lot of talk about dysfunction. A lot of people want to talk about they're from dysfunctional families, and I know it to be true. And I do not want to be different. I, too, am from a dysfunctional family. You're looking at the dysfunction in my family. But, you know, I was given every advantage that a human could ever want in life as a young boy, and it was never enough. And I didn't know what any of that meant, but I just knew that it was never enough. I can tell you they talked to me about my attitudes before they talked to me about my drinking. I can tell you that very early in life I made a decision I wanted to become a man, and my interpretation of that is someone that goes out in the world and competes, and there's no such thing as failure. And I tried to do that with everything I had. And it continued, and really the four C's really characterized my drinking. I drank in the beginning for comfort, then I drank for courage, then I crossed that line from controlled to uncontrolled drinking, and I drank compulsively. And the end result in every area of my life was total corruption. Change became my middle name, because when I became uncomfortable in any area of my life, I made a change. In other words, I was a runner, a drinker, and a drunk. But I continued to do the things that I had to do, and I thought that I had to do. I had no idea of the underlying things that were driving me, none whatsoever. But I can tell you what alcohol did for me. It took away everything near and dear to me. It took away my family. It took away my lifelong friends. It took away an athletic career. It took away health. It damn near took away my life. It took away everything. And mine, like yours, is one of progression. And I'll just tell you a little about that. But I was to get out of school, and I went to college, and I was to get out of college, and it was expected I'd go in a family business that was two generations old, and, you know, I turned my back on that. One more time to go out and try to prove me to you. And I spent a lot of time out there trying to prove me to you, desperately trying to prove me to you. And I went to work for a large company in the southeastern part of the country, and I grew up in a very strict home. There was no drinking, a very strict religion. No, I'm not Irish Catholic. It probably was worse than that. I grew up as a Southern Baptist, and but I tell you, when I got out of that home and got out of that area, it was like letting midnight out of chute nine, because I couldn't get enough of it fast enough. I loved everything that went with drinking. I loved the bar scene. I loved it all. And my life just centered around that. I've learned everything in life in retrospect. I have to get out beyond it to look back to see what really happened. And that's still true today. You know, I get out beyond situations, I look back, and I can see the realism, I can see the truth. And things continued, and, you know, it wasn't long. They talked to me a little about my attitudes. And I had that facade going, that ego, you know, and underneath it, I was scared to death. Oh, I was fear-driven. I had no idea of that. But, you know, I knew how to act out. I knew how to act as if, even back there, before I heard that, when they brought me back to Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew how to act as if. And I tried that for as long as I could. And I started to make a lot of changes. And when I wasn't making changes, they were made for me. In other words, I lost jobs. I lost relationships. I lost everything. And I stayed with this company. It was an oil company, and they transferred me a couple of times. And I finally ended up in Atlanta, Georgia, and as a direct result of my alcoholism, I was finally fired from that company. And just as I was fired, another door opened. I've had a lot of doors opened in life. I've had a lot closed, too. And I got re-involved in athletics, and here I am, a leader of men every day and a drunk every night. The Jekyll and Hyde we know so much about. And, you know, it wasn't long before they started to question me about my drinking. And why do you do the things you do, say the things you say, act the way you act? And, you know, I didn't have answers for them. But as soon as I thought they knew about Len Wilder, then I had to look for another change. But anyway, I was to lose that job as a direct result of my alcoholism. And I found myself pulling a trailer with my possessions in it through the mountains of Tennessee back to my hometown of Lexington, Kentucky. And it's amazing, we talk about willingness in the program. I used to, when I was against the wall and had no place else to turn, and I would become willing. And I didn't know that was the word at the time, but I became willing to go back in the family business because I I had no other place to go. I looked around and most of my friends were meeting their responsibilities. They had jobs, they were married, and I thought, that's the answer, I need to get married. Unfortunately for the lady that was involved, here I am, an insecure, immature, irresponsible drunk. So I get married. And we had a baby daughter out of that marriage, and fortunately for them, within a year, they were able to get away from me and go back to Chicago. And she was a lovely person. And I had to go on with my drunkenness, and it started to progress and to really gallop. And I will tell you that I got fired from my own family business, and I could take you all over these United States from here on. I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous over 45 years ago in Atlanta, Georgia. I came to on Christmas morning. I was rolled up. I'd been a blackout drinker for the past 4 or 5 years. I was rolled up in the fetal position. I was terrified. A man had worked at the company that I worked for first when I was out of college, and it was whispered that he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I knew not what else to do, and I picked the phone up and called that man, and he and his wife came to get me on Christmas Day. And they're the ones that took me through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time. And I started to swing in and out of meetings, and everything you said went in one ear and out the other, because I wasn't seeing, I wasn't hearing, and I didn't want to be. And so naturally, you know what happened. And they talked about all the things that happened to us if we'd be alcoholic and continue to drink. They talked about loss of homes, jobs, family, health, the jails, the institutions. I said, not me, I'm different. Not me, I'm different. So for 2.5 years, I swung in and out of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous all over these United States, using the people within the fellowship to prove how different I was not. And all of those things had to happen to me, and I never want to forget that. I finally, in 1984, got off an airplane at Los Angeles Airport, and I stood right in the middle of my wardrobe. Yet I was still defending my right to drink. And I never want to forget the next few months, because basically they were spent on the streets of Los Angeles. And I like to stand up here and tell you I was a street person. And no, I wasn't a street person. I was terrified the whole time. But I did whatever was necessary to try to continue my drinking. And little by little, things started to happen. I had 2 seizures here, not here, but in California, the last of which was in the Church of Religious Science on 6th Street in Los Angeles. And I don't remember, the only thing I remember was coming to at County General Hospital. And as a matter of fact, I'll talk a little about the man that meant so much to me and thousands of others in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the way I found out that I had been taken from that church to Central Receiving and then County Hospital when I had that seizure was I was with Chuck after I had about 2 years of sobriety, and he used to go to that church and share. And I went with him one Sunday, and he introduced me to the music director, and he said, oh, I know Lynn. And I thought, oh, he said, we took him in Dr. Hornaday's car to Central Receiving. And, you know, I never want to forget those things. And I've swung in and out. You see, I still didn't want to be alcoholic, and I still didn't want to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a booze fighter, and it finally just beat me to death. The bottle finally just beat me to death. And a lot of things had to happen along the way. I finally ended up at a place called the Cecil Hotel. Matter of fact, speaking of history, that's where the first AA meeting was held in Los Angeles in 1939. A man named Mark Joseph held it there. But then it was the Skid Row Hotel. And I ended up there in a room with 2 other winos. And I was put on the street, not by the hotel, but by the 2 winos. And I was in horrible shape. The last thing I hung on to was the physical part of the disease. I thought, if I can stay in shape physically, I don't have a drinking problem. That all had to go. And there was a social worker that found me and could tell that I was in really bad shape. And I asked her to please take me to a place at the corner of 3rd and Vermont. There was a man there that would always give me a bed. He wasn't a member of AA or anything. He had a lot of alcoholics in his family. But he gave me a bed in a room, and this lady went home, and she was greatly concerned. She called her family doctor. He had a patient that was a sober member of AA, and this man and another man came and got a key and came into that room. And I tried to get up off the floor one more time, tell him who I was. And who I was a sick, dying drunk. And they put me in a sanitarium and detoxed me on Fairfax Avenue. And about 3 days later, I came to. I was in DTs, and the doctor was standing there telling me what I'd heard for the last 3 years. I had no idea that I'd had my last drink. I had no idea that a surrender had taken place in my life. I cried out in silent desperation to no one in particular, help. I knew AA didn't work because I'd been in and out of AA all over these United States. I knew there was no God because if there were a God, why was I in the shape that I was in? But I cried one more time for help. I had to stay in that sanitarium probably about 10 days. They were to take me out of there, and they convinced a place that I'd been 86th from called the Bimini. It's still around today in central Los Angeles to let me come back there. And I had the shakes. I was still shaking badly. They put me in the kitchen. They said, well, you're shaking too badly to wash dishes. Maybe you can dry them. And I did the best I could, but it took a while, I want to tell you. But the one thing I'd do, I'd sit in the meetings at the Bimini. I'd go to the other places, the Royal Palms or Central Los Angeles, the Arlington Group. I could sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and not pick up a drink. And a little bit, I was real rummy. I heard a man talk very early in my sobriety, and the only thing I came away from was no human can live the way that man talks. No human can live the way that man talks. I heard him about 2 or 3 weeks later, and I thought the same thing. I heard him again pretty quickly, and he came over and sat down to me and said, son, how you doing? I said, terrific. He knew better. He wrote his name on the back on a piece of paper, gave me a phone number, said, I want you to call me, and I want you to come down to my office, or I'll come get you. I didn't call him. Somebody took me to the Beverly Hills Men's Stag 2 or 3 weeks later, and he was there. That was his home group at the time. And he came over and said, you didn't call me. I said, no. And the man that was the founder of the Mary Lynn Foundation and the Bimini and the Royal Palm and the Shoreham at that time was a man named Pat Wigger. He was a former cop, and he was tough. And I was terrified of him. And Chuck looked at me and said, if you don't call me tomorrow, I'm going to call Pat. And I called him. And this man started to pick me up, or if I could get a pass, I'd catch the bus to his office, and I started to ride with him. I had no idea who he was. He just shared his experience, strength, and hope with me. And, you know, he talked about all the old-timers, and he talked about his relationship with Bill, our co-founder, and I loved him. And everywhere I went, everyone loved him. And I eventually got out of that place. I moved to the San Fernando Valley, which is another area of greater Los Angeles. I moved in with two sober alcoholics. I had an original sponsor. And, you know, these guys had jobs. They were going to meetings regularly. I was unemployed, unemployable. I'd get up every morning and walk 2.5 miles to the North Hollywood Clubhouse on Radford Street. I'd be standing there when the doors open, and I'd walk in. And the old-timers back then were tough. The Larry Blakes, the Mike Rosses, and everything, they immediately put me in the kitchen making coffee. And they would tell you not to open your mouth. And you didn't. At least I didn't, and most people didn't. And little by little, some things started to change for me. I had just barely started the uncovering process. We come in here, we uncover, we discover, we discard, and we recover. And I very slowly started that. A group of men came to me at one of the meetings one night, said, we're going on a sober weekend with men this weekend. We want you to go with us. I said, oh, I can't. They said, oh, you can be on the curb at 4 o'clock. They told me what to bring. I said, I don't have any of that. They said, doesn't matter. I said, I don't have any money. They said, doesn't matter. I got in the car with these men. There were three men driving. I got in the back seat. They started to talk about the Jesuits. They started to talk about a retreat called, a house called the Manresa. I thought, my God, they're taking me to a Catholic retreat. They're going to try to convert me. I'll never forget going up that long driveway to Manresa and seeing those two men standing at the top of those stairs in those long black robes. And I was scared to death. One of them was a man named Father Frank Parrish, who was head of that retreat house at that point. He was not an alcoholic. The other was an alcoholic priest named Father Barney Nixon. And thank God for that man, because he literally led me out of the wilderness. He was the greatest teacher of the 12 steps I ever encountered. And Chuck even used to say that. And thank you. And, you know, I got to know, I bonded with that man. We became great, great friends. And he started to do more and more retreats in Southern California, and I'd take him home between retreats, and he'd stay with me, or he'd stay with Chuck. And I used to, Katie knows about it, I used to love to listen to those two men talk about sobriety and debate whatever was the topic of the day. And thank God for that, because those old-timers really gave me the foundation. But I was pushed into service. I didn't even know what service was. I know today that the two most important things we have in our life are love and service. But I was at a meeting at Ohio Street on a Monday night, and I was probably about 5.5, 6 months sober. And somebody said the coffee maker had gotten drunk. Anyone make coffee? And I raised my hand. And that hall is still around today. It's where the Pacific group started in that Tuesday night in that hall. And there's a kitchen there, and I would make the coffee, and before I knew it, I was making coffee for five groups. And you know, I tell you what that did for me. I didn't know that was being of service, but it made me feel a little better. It made me feel what I could see in your eyes that I wanted so desperately and knew I would never have. I was afraid to tell you my story or anything about me, because I knew if I did, that you'd tell me to go away. Little did I know there was nothing I could tell you that you wouldn't identify with. And I want to welcome our new friends that are here tonight. And I want to tell you that we love you. And you may not feel that, but truly we love you. And we care about you, and we're glad you're on the path with us. And please stay here. Please grab somebody tonight before you leave here. Get some phone numbers and use them, because it'll save your life. It saved mine over and over and over in the beginning. And back then, you could dial a payphone for a nickel. So it's been a while. And but anyway, I learned to use the phone. And little by little, things started to happen for me. Finally, a group surrounded me in the valley one night of men and said, "Lynn, we think you should get a job." And I said, "Really?" And they said, "Yeah," and they told me exactly how to do it. They told me to get the Los Angeles Times out, go down the Help Wanted column, call the numbers, show up for an interview. If I could get one, the first person offered me a job, say yes. And you know something? I'd like to tell you I was able to do that. Some days I'd call and make the appointments, but I couldn't show up for the interviews. Other days I'd call, somebody would answer, I'd hang up. Every night those men asked me how the job process was going. I'd say, "Oh, great, I had 2-3 interviews today." They let that go on for the better part of 2 or 3 weeks, and then on a Friday night at a meeting in the valley, they finally said to me, "Lynn, it's real apparent to us you can't get a job." I said, "Oh, no, I got a job offer today." They said, "What company?" I said, "Pacific Mutual Life Insurance Company." Now, they'd been all over the Times advertising. I'd never darkened their doors. These guys knew that. They said, "Lynn, that's fine. In the interim, we've got a job for you." And the job was as a janitor in the church where this meeting was 3 days a week. And I took that job, and it lasted, I don't know how long, very short period of time. They fired me. I found myself going back down Vineland Avenue to the North Hollywood Clubhouse. I passed a service station. Had a sign in the window said, "Help Wanted." And I went in the night. The manager said, "I'm looking for someone to pump gas on the swing shift. Can you do it?" And my reaction to that normally would be to tell him of my training with Standard Oil Company. I've been in retail sales, industrial sales, yakety yak, but all I said was, "Yes, I can do it." And I went to work pumping gas, and when I wasn't pumping gas, I was in AA meetings. And I was let go from that job because I wasn't bondable. And then someone suggested I sell encyclopedias. I said, "Oh, I can do that." But there were nights when I couldn't even knock on a door, couldn't ring a doorbell. But the uncovering process started, and you know, I started to get into the steps. And I got direction, and I followed it. And you know, things started to change for me. It was just unbelievable. I had an opportunity to do a couple of things, but I never want to forget that first year. And, you know, my total income was $1,237, and I was overpaid. And I thought I was going to get re-involved in athletics, but that didn't happen. But some things started to happen for me. And I tell you one thing that I didn't tell you, and it's a story that's just when they brought me back to Alcoholics Anonymous, the insanity part of my illness stepped to, this is a perfect example of when I was drinking. And I ended up in a lot of detox places. They would detox you and put you on the street. Or if they couldn't get you in a detox, AA members would come sit with you around the clock. They'd give you fruit juice and honey. They'd walk you. And I mean, it was and all of that. And I came to one morning and had no idea where I was. And I looked over, and there was no doorknob on my side of the door. And I was in Milledgeville, Georgia, which was the state nut house, as a direct result of my disease. Now, as I stand here tonight, I don't remember them saying anything about the disease of alcoholism the whole time I was there, or about Alcoholics Anonymous. But that had nothing to do with anything, because I'd already been introduced to AA. And the way they treated you in there was they gave you massive doses of Thorazine and Librium. And I want to tell you, they gave you enough Thorazine where if you got up and down the hall in a day, you'd have a hell of a day. And I was there almost 5 weeks. And they finally let me out. And I had a bus ticket and $3 in my pocket. And the bus ticket was to Atlanta. I called that athletic director that had fired me from that job a couple of years before. And he asked me where I was, and I told him I was coming to Atlanta. He said, "Lynn, we're going to Lexington tomorrow, and there's a seat on the airplane for you if you'd like to go with us." And then he said, "Where are you staying tonight?" I said, "I have no place to stay." He said, "When you get off the bus, you go to the YMCA." And I got off that bus and went to the YMCA and got up early the next morning and rode to the airport with the team, flew to Lexington, went to Memorial Coliseum. And I knew that arena well, and you know, they worked out and everything. We went down, checked in the old hotel in downtown Lexington. And I heard them go over the pregame plan and everything. And I'd also had another job at this school that they fired me from. I was the color commentator on the radio network for this university when I was there. And the play-by-play announcer was still there, and he's still a friend of mine today. And, you know, they went out. It was a noon game the following day. They'd started to televise college basketball, and I had a lot of nervous energy going. I was scared to death, but I knew I'd never take another drink. I knew that I would never, ever take another drink. And this is where the insanity part of the illness comes in. We went back down to the hotel. I had dinner with the whole group. There was an 8 o'clock flight the next morning. I went up, I went to bed, turned the light off, my alcoholic thinker went on. And it said, "I wonder who's in the Bluegrass Lounge," which is the bar in that hotel that I didn't see. The other side said, "Go to sleep." I went back and forth, found myself dressing myself, walking to the elevator, down the elevator, in the lobby, across the lobby, into the bar, ordering ginger ale for the better part of 45 minutes or so. I found myself then going down the steps through that revolving door across Main Street to the Golden Horseshoe, another bar, ordering a drink. Alcoholism, yes. Insanity, yes. Progression, yes. They left that hotel the next morning. 3 days later, I was taken out of that hotel by the riot squad that my dad had sent. He was the city manager of that town at that time. The next morning in my jail cell, two men showed up that I loved dearly. One had been my first basketball coach. The other was a guy that was an acting police judge that's not a lot older than I am today. He wasn't then. And Tommy looked at me and said, "Lynn, what is it?" And he had that look in his eye, and I didn't know what to tell him. The other guy said, "Lynn, if you come back," and he was the police judge, "and do what you've done the last few days, we're going to lock you up permanently," all as a direct result of my disease. They took me out of that jail cell, down to the bottom floor, across the back parking lot, and put me on a bus with a one-way ticket. And Tom said to me, "What can I do?" And I didn't know what to tell him. And I had to go on from there until I landed in Los Angeles, landed in that detox, and I told you all of that. But that showed me the insanity part of my illness. Because when I came out of Milledgeville, I knew at the depth of my very being that I would never, ever pick up another drink. Yet 3 days later, I picked that drink up. And anyway, after my first year of sobriety, little by little, some things started to change in my life. I'd gotten active in the program. And I remember the first Southern California convention in my first year. It was in Santa Monica. I can remember I so desperately wanted to be a part of, and I went to the auditorium. I stood outside, and on Friday night, I was so fearful I didn't go in. And I finally got up the courage to go in and sit in the balcony the next day. And the following year, I got involved in the service end of it, just showing up. And back then, you know, they would give you jobs to do. It didn't matter whether you were a greeter, they were smoking cigarettes in meetings then. You were cleaning the ashtray, you were picking the cigarette butts up, whatever it is. You get involved. And boy, what a blessing that is. It And I got involved in service work in a lot of different areas, and particularly in conference and convention work. And the second year I was sober, I was told to call a man that was head of the Southern California Convention, and I said, what can I do? He said, I don't know, but there's a man in Laguna Beach, I didn't live in Laguna, that's got a new idea. Why don't you call him? And I called this man, and he had an idea that we'll start, and it was in San Diego that year, in an old hotel. He said, I think I'm going to start some meetings that we'll run 1 hour each, and we'll run them for 6 to 8 hours. And he said, I don't know what you could do. And then he said the magic sentence. He said, but I think probably we'll try to make coffee. I said, I can do that. And you know what? That's where the marathon started in Southern California that year. That guy's name was Warren Snyder. I loved him. And I'm going to tell you something. I didn't leave that basement room down there the whole time except to go to the bathroom. You know, and that got me involved in that area, and I'm so grateful for all of the opportunities that I've been given. I treat sobriety every day as a gift, and the first thing every morning I say, thank you, God, for the gift of sobriety. That's where I start my morning prayer, and I'm so grateful for that. And you know, things went on from there. In my second year of sobriety, I was sitting in the Brentwood speakers meeting, West LA, and the most beautiful lady I had ever seen in my life. She was 5'10", blonde, absolutely gorgeous. She was young. She walked to the podium to read chapter 5. And it's a program of attraction, and I wanted what she had. Her name was Pam Floyd, and it became Pam Floyd Wilder. And what an incredible life we embarked on. Then we were living and still living in Los Angeles. We were heavily involved in West LA and all over, everywhere. She was heavily involved with women. We were involved in just all groups, and things were good. And I finally finished, got through the eighth and ninth step with my original sponsor, and he came back to me, and I knew that I had left this part out. And I told you about that lady I married right out of college, and that baby daughter we had, and I hadn't seen her in almost 9 years. And Bud came to me and said, Len, you forgot part of you, and I knew what he was going to talk about. You forgot part of your amends. And I said, really, what? I knew. And he said, what about Gail? I said, yeah. And the reason I'd forgotten it, you know, I was so filled with fear of rejection, abandonment, that I just had that fear going, and I was afraid to look at that. And he told me exactly what to do. He told me how to sit down and write a letter and to send it, and I did just the opposite of what he told me to do. I don't suggest that. I was pulling a lawyer off bar stools in L.A. I'd like to tell you I was carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't. I was trying to get him to get visitation rights so I could go see this daughter. He did, and I did. And I got on that airplane at LAX to fly to Chicago. I'd called her mother in a demanding way, said, I'm coming back to see Gail. I'm going to spend the weekend with her. I want to tell you, I'd done everything but pick up a drink. I was on the worst dry drunk I'd pray that I will ever be on. I'm sure it will be. But I got to Chicago. I got off. I checked into a downtown hotel, and I knew I was crazy. You taught me well, because I picked the phone up and called central office. They said, you're 2 blocks from a meeting at 6 p.m. I hit the pavement, walked in a place called the Mustard Seed in downtown Chicago. And I tell you, the only thing, I came out of there an hour later, a little less crazy than when I walked in there. I went back to the hotel room. I called her mother. I said, what time can I pick Gail up? She said, Len, she doesn't want to see you. And thank God it happened that way. Because, you know, I got on my knees that night, and I said, God, you take it. You take it, God. It's in your hands. I got up and wrote both those ladies a separate letter of amends, my daughter and her mother. I'll never forget going down and getting stamps the next morning, mailing them. I flew back to California. I was given another freedom. I stayed in touch with her on her birthday at Easter. I'd write her notes, write her letters, and just tell her I loved her. And a year later, she walked into our home in Laguna Beach. We had moved to Laguna. And she's quite a young woman today. She was able to go to college in California. And on her graduation, her mother flew out with her new family and children, and by then, Pam and I had two. We had a daughter born in Los Angeles named Allison, son born in Laguna Beach named Jim. We sat on one side of her. I sat between Gail's mother and Pam. And as Gail walked up on that stage to get her diploma, her mother turned to me and said, "Lynn, I can't thank you enough for what you've done for Gail." I said, "Don't thank me. Thank Alcoholics Anonymous. Because nothing is possible or would have been possible or is today without this program. I know that for fact." She went on to law school. She's been a lawyer for a number of years and lives in West L.A. She's an incredible lady and a woman. And the restoration of that relationship, every relationship I had, and I'd run through a lot of people, you know, is all as a direct result of this program, practicing the principles thereof, and a loving God. And things went on from there, and things were good in our life. 1984, I'd talked at a conference in Florida on a Saturday night. I went to the room. I was with an Al-Anon lady I love that's been dead for a number of years named Ramona from Oklahoma. She said, "Let's go call Pam." We went to the room, called her. I said, "How are you, honey?" And I was going on from there some other places before I went home. She said, "Oh, I'm fine. I've got a little back pain, but I've been soaking in the tub." 10.5 months later, she was dead. It was leukemia, and we spent most of that time at the UCLA hospital, and you surrounded us. I mean by you, I mean members of Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon members, Alateen members, because I had the great privilege at that time of co-sponsoring an Alateen group. You surrounded us. You were in line to give blood at UCLA. You were in Laguna taking care of our children. That's what we do for one another. You know, that's what we do. I truly believe that we are put here. I think we are really put here to serve one another. I believe that from the bottom of my soul. And that was certainly an example. And I've seen many others go on like that in Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank God that we've got that. I know of no other society in the world that has what we have. And I'm so grateful for that. I had no idea what the mothers of the world do, but I had to learn, and I started to grow up with my kids. You taught me two real important things. You taught me the ability to be honest and tell the truth, and you taught me how to communicate. And I started to do that with my kids. And we'd sit in the beds some nights and just talk, and sometimes, you know, they were a little ahead of me in their growth pattern, I thought. But I tell you, regardless of what's gone on in my life, and it's called life, and we're all here living it, and Katie talked about it. There are bumps in the road. There are things that we go through. And if you want to become an old-timer, you don't drink and you don't die. That's the way you get here. But I want to tell you, there are things that go on. I've had relationship things that go on. I've had death. I've had situations with my children. I've had financial difficulties. I've had health issues. But you just keep showing up. And every day, I say, "Thank you, God, for my sobriety. Thank you, God, for the opportunities you've given me." And it continues on. And I became willing when Pam got sick. I had some really tough situations going on in my business life. I had my own company. I had some things going on, and I had some real financial difficulties. And I asked God every day just to allow me to take care of her. And you know something? He did that. And he also allowed us to complete that relationship in a beautiful and loving way with our children. And when she stepped into the next room, we were all in the room with her. And thank God for that. She was an incredible woman, an incredible member of Alcoholics Anonymous. She taught me a lot. She taught me a lot about intimacy and how to love, and I'll be forever grateful for that. And our kids are all grown today. I've told you about that daughter, the oldest daughter. The second one is a school teacher, and she looks just like her mother. She's beautiful. She's a school teacher. Her husband's a school teacher and a coach, and they've given us two grandsons. We got a 4-year-old and one that just turned one. And, you know, I'm so grateful for that. You know, I could have missed it all. And about 5 years ago, we were at an AA birthday party in Laguna Beach, a guy I sponsored, and a lot of loud music going and everything, and somebody handed me a cell phone and said, "Take this call." I said, "No, I can't hear." He said, "It's an emergency. Go inside." And my son had left home and had gone to school in the East, had worked in New York, and continued his education at another school, and was living in Boston. And I took the phone, and his girlfriend said he was missing and had been missing for 18 hours. They couldn't find him anywhere. And we left that party, and I tell you, it was a long night. And I thought he was dead. And all I could do was pray and put him in God's hands. And about 11 o'clock the next morning, on a Sunday morning, that phone rang, and it was Jim. And he said, "Dad, I need help." And I had no idea. I look back today, and I have an idea of some of the things that happened to him. Because he was still fully employed. He'd always been tremendously successful at everything he'd done. But I can look back today at some of the stories he told and see it. I had no idea. And I thought, who do I know in Boston? I knew the Indian who I'd been places with. John, he was dead. I knew another man moved to Florida. And I said, "Jim, you need to just find an AA meeting." And I suggest he call central office. And there's a guy now, head of our general service office, that's done an incredible job that I've known since his early sobriety. I was involved in it on Maui. His name's Greg M. He's still there today, and I called Greg in New York. He said, "Have Jim call me." Jim called him, and he put a couple and two other men right in Jim's lap. And he, like his dad, didn't want to be alcoholic, and he didn't want to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he swung in and out of the doors for about 11 months. And I finally got a call one day saying, "Dad, I'm not getting it. Do you think I ought to go through treatment?" I said, "Jim, that's your decision." He got on an airplane, flew to California, went through treatment, went through the Betty Ford Center for 30 days, and he got out. And I got to tell you, he's so involved in Alcoholics Anonymous that it just, I just sit there in awe and listen to him and everything. And he was asked to share at the International Convention in Toronto with 2 years. A lot of people thought I had something to do with it. I didn't have anything to do with it. Greg knew him. Other people knew him. They asked him to share. I sat in that room. It was packed. There were three speakers. He was the last one. First guy from Florida, had 32 years. He was head of the substance abuse program in the state of Florida. The next lady was head of central office in Cleveland. She had 29 years. And then Jim got up there with 2 years. And his honesty and everything. I tell you, I sat there on the second row about where Bob's sitting, and all I could do was cry. And all I could do was just close my eyes and say, "Thank you, God. Thank you, God, that he's gotten the gift that I've had for all of these years. Thank you." We got off that sober boat got home Sunday. We got a telephone call. He's engaged. And he's flying from San Francisco down to spend the weekend with us this weekend. And, you know, light up my life. Light up my life through sober living, through Alcoholics Anonymous, and for every gift we've been given here. You know, I'm so grateful. And life goes on. I became willing one more time over 12 years ago, and I hadn't been in the corporate world forever. And I went back in the corporate world. I got up at 4:30 every morning, and I drove to downtown Los Angeles from Laguna Beach. And rather than getting on the freeway and saying, "Why me?" Every morning I said, "Thank you, God, for the opportunity. Thank you, God, for the opportunity." I told those people, they had asked me to come in and help them put together a site development division. I said, "I'll do it for 6 months. It'll be 13 years in November. I can tell you I'm the oldest fool there, but I got people working with me and for me that are my kids' age. But I'm, what a blessing. What a blessing it is to have that. 10 years ago, we'd moved our offices finally to Orange County, which really helped. And a lady walked in that company, and everybody started talking about her and everything. And I said, "No, I haven't met her." And I heard her laughter. And then I met her. And then something really interesting happened. We became friends. And and we did a lot of things together. We had a lot of fun. And I was dressed kind of like I am tonight, one Friday night, leaving the office. And she said, "Where are you going dressed up like that? Do you have a date?" I said, "Yes, I do. I'm going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous to speak." She said, "You're an alcoholic? I said, yes, I am. She had no idea. She thought I drank because we had so much fun. She didn't pay any attention. She said, it's an open meeting, St. Jude's Hospital. And she said, oh, I couldn't do that. I said, why not? So I talked her into going. We walked in that room, and the roof was coming off, the energy in that room. She didn't look right. She didn't look left. We sat up front. She didn't move. And she had never heard my story. And you know what? After that meeting, we left, and we went for coffee, and she looked across the table at me. Her eyes were about like saucers, and she said, do you think they thought I was alcoholic? I said, are you kidding? They're so self-obsessed, they didn't even know you were there. And we fell in love, and we've been together a long time. We're about to celebrate 7 years of marriage next month. And, you know, she's been a blessing in my life. And if she were here tonight or if you were to meet her, she'll tell you that the most wonderful people she's ever met in her life are members of our fellowships. And she was on that cruise with me last week, and she loves AA, she loves Al-Anon. Her story is she walked out of an alcoholic marriage. That's her story, not mine. But anyway, it's just absolutely incredible. I'm just so blessed today. I'll tell you a couple other quick things I want to tell you, and then I'm going to stop. You never know what's next. And I've always been active in every area and everything, and not only in AA, but in life. And a couple of years ago, I had my annual physical. My doctor sent me, he said, I want you to go to a hematologist just for a check. And this lady tested me for 3 to 4 months, did biopsies, did a lot of things, and finally came up with a diagnosis of multiple myeloma. And that's a rare form of bone marrow blood cancer. And, our disease is from the neck up, and I was walking out of that office planning my funeral. And I want to tell you, I went through some down times, even doing what I could. I continued to do all of it. I continued to stay active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I continued to do it all, but I was terrified. And then I had to get back to the third step, back to the 11th step, and, just accept it. But what they put in front of that diagnosis was the word indolent. And that means inactive. And so I go for blood work. I go once a year for bone work. And it's indolent. And the last time I was at, you'll love this, when she diagnosed me like that, I went back to her a month later and I tried to talk her out of the diagnosis. But you know what? I went back and in December, and I won't go back and see her again probably this December. She said, Lynn, you're probably a die from something else first. And I looked at her and I said, well, tell my head that, will you? But you know what? I put it in God's hands, and I'm fine. It took me a little while to get to the acceptance part of that. It took me a little while. I'm not going to tell you that. I just came out and said, oh, God, I put you in your hands. God, I'm going to be wonderful. But I'm there. And thank God for the program, or I wouldn't be there. I just want to tell you quickly, because it's around that time of year. I didn't talk about this until about 7 or 8 years ago, and a couple of guys that I sponsored, I'd done some book study things with them and taken them through the steps and told them about my early experiences, said, you need to start telling this. Chuck used to tell me about his relationship with Bill, and I used to say I'd love to meet him. And in my third year of sobriety, although I wasn't living in Laguna Beach, and I got a call from Chuck, and he said, Elsa and I are going to be, Elsa was Chuck's wife, and I'm talking about Chuck C. And he said, Elsa and I are going to be in Connecticut over the weekend of such and such, and I'm going to be in New York with Bill on Monday. And if you can get back, you can meet him. Well, I flew the red eye back, went to the old General Service office, and walked in that office and listened to those two men the better part of an afternoon, just the three of us in there. And they asked me to go to dinner with them that night, Bill and Lois and Chuck and Elsa. And I tell you, I flew home on the red eye that night. I'll never, ever forget that. The last thing Bill said to me, if you ever come back to New York, and his health had started to fail a little bit then. He said, if you ever come back to New York, you call me. And I started to do some business in New York, and the following year I was going back, and I said to Chuck, I'm not going to call. He said, you better. And I was in Midtown. I had a meeting canceled, a luncheon meeting, and I called the office, the General Service office, And I said, is Bill in? And they said, yes. Who's calling? He came on the phone. He said, where are you? I said, I'm in Midtown. He said, come down here. I got in a cab, went down there. When I got there, he had sandwiches. He got up and shut the door. He could tell that he had a young guy on fire with Alcoholics Anonymous and sobriety. And I can tell you what he talked about the entire time I was in that office, the 12 traditions. Because I think of all the things that he wrote and did for us, he loved those the most. And as you all know, he had a difficult time getting those approved in 1950. But Dr. Bob helped him tremendously with that. But he loved the traditions. And that's all I'd like to tell you. I came running out of there and became a traditionalist. I didn't, but within time I did. And a great friend of mine, I was talking to Judy about it tonight. He loved the traditions too. A guy named Chuck Nesbitt's been dead for quite a while. Chuck and I found a traditions group, and I went to it on a regular basis. And I want to tell you, in this alcoholic's life, those traditions are as important to me as the 12 steps of recovery. And I'm grateful. I'm grateful for all of those opportunities. I was telling a story. I was sitting with Barbara and Charlie on the boat, and Barbara was talking about the Al-Anons and everything. And the last time Lois Wilson spoke in California was at the family meeting, the Palm Springs Roundup. And I had the great, and they let her stay seated. And I had met her several times before that, but they let her stay seated, and she was just incredible. And I was the alcoholic on that family meeting program. And then she went home with us, and people from Fishkill, New York had brought her out here, and they spent a couple of days with us. And I got to talk to her a lot. I got to talk to her on an airline flight from Dallas to New York once. The whole time she told me all about the motorcycle and the sidecar, and I'm so grateful. And the year after Pam died in 1985, I got a call from those people and said, can you come back to Stepping Stone? And I'm glad I went in 86, because she died in 88. And I got to tell you, some of the great alcoholics stood great, great women. Elsa Chamberlain was like a surrogate mother to me. I'll be forever grateful for everything she did in my life. Lois Wilson. I got to know Smitty. And of course, Smitty, Bill was called Dr. Bob Smitty, but he had a son named Smitty that was in Al-Anon. And I got to know him over the years, but not well. And about 3 years ago, I was at the Georgia State Convention. They took the speakers to dinner, and I sat across from Smitty. His wife had died. He'd remarried. He'd moved out of Texas to Memphis. And I said, Smitty, I've never had an opportunity to really talk to you. And he said, well, let's have breakfast in the morning. I'm so grateful that happened, because we had breakfast the next morning. I got to ask him questions that been on my mind for years, and to talk about the early beginnings in Akron and in the Smith household. And he talked on Sunday morning. Somebody said to me Saturday night after I talked to him, you're going to go see the film in the morning. I said, what film? Anyway, they'd made a documentary called House of Miracles, and I knew nothing about it. And I went over the next morning in the arena, and they showed that, and then he talked. And you could tell he wasn't doing well, and they took him off the stage and right to the airport, and a few months later he died. And I'm blessed. I'm so blessed for all of the old-timers, for the experiences I've had, and for all that have come after them. I sit around today with newcomers and hear them talk about things that I didn't even think about in my first early beginnings. And I love to go to meetings and listen to people share their experience, strength, and hope. I have never left an AA meeting that I didn't come out of there with something new or something that I could use. And that's why I keep showing up. I'm so very, very grateful for all of the opportunities, the gifts of sobriety. And I'm grateful to be here tonight. And I'm going to close with a story that I always close with, and it really sums up what I'm trying to share. And it's the story of a man that owned a fine Swiss watch, and he loved it more than any possession he'd ever had in his lifetime. And it quit running on him one day, and he took it to a watchmaker, and he fixed it. And he went through a series of watchmakers, and he knew not what else to do. And finally, one morning, one more time, he was sitting in his den with his desk lamp on, and one more time he was winding that watch. And he started to put it on his wrist, and he thought he saw a couple of scratches, and he got his magnifying glass out. And they weren't scratches at all. It was a small inscription. And it said very simply, in case of trouble, return to Maker. And I love that. In case of trouble, return to Maker. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love being sober, and I love all of you. Thank you.